welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
This may be the longest episode we've ever recorded because it's going to last 70 years, if I'm counting that down right.
Does it have to last that, or will it only feel like
it's
that?
It's just going to feel...
Buckle in, folks.
Yeah, hang on.
If you're on your Peloton, slow it down because this is going to be a long haul.
3, 2, 1. All right, Hal, here, let's go with minute 111.
With the exhaustive synopsis. All right. Darkness envelops Steve Rogers until his eyes flutter open, revealing a sterile hospital bed bathed in soft light. A radio hums quietly at his bedside, its faint broadcast filling the silence. He lies still, disoriented, as the world around him begins to come into focus.
Wow, so much to talk about.
We have so much fun, and you know, and Brian has led us, and I've learned so much and gotten thinking about this different way about color palettes. That's always been something I've been sort of aware of as a layperson, but my interest has been so refined by these discussions. And like in this, what 30 seconds is just black. What do you got for me there, Fees? I mean, come on, what's
that? No, I got a lot about that, actually, but let me back up to the 10 seconds before that, where we see the children playing in the streets with the
Yes.
Good.
Vintage Joe right there.
Boy, that's a sweet moment. And yet they're running down the street. It's got to be New York. It looks like New York. And there's I took note of the Broussard's Pharmacy, which has cut prices, best quality, vitamins, and X-Lax. And a Lucky O'Malley's, which I take to be a bar, because what else would Lucky O'Malley's be? But these kids running down the street with their little pageboy caps, and they look like newsies, you know? But what an evocative thing of Captain America's legacy lives on in the hearts of these children. And the music swells. You get the Captain America theme. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. It's like, oh, man, right in the feels.
And I know, Hal, I know when you were watching this thing, you instantly flash back to the end of The Rocketeer.
It rhymes so perfectly.
Oh, me too.
Rocketeer to the rescue.
Yeah, we've seen, and what a great way to, in just a few seconds without any exposition, to show the impact these heroes have had on culture. You know, is when you see kids, you know, playing and things. And I've told this story more than once on this show about my brother and the metal garbage can lids. And as long as he yelled Captain America before he threw the metal lid at me, somehow the rule said that was okay, even though it didn't hurt any less. Yeah. But I have to say that, like, the second this, seeing this in the theater, 15 years ago now, we got to this scene. There's a kid with a garbage can lid and he's playing Captain America. It's like, that's when my healing began. Like, I saw this and it's like, oh, that's not traumatic anymore. It's just sweet. It's just fine. I'm okay now.
Well, the last time we talked about this, Hal, I told the story of me getting my front tooth chipped by a trash can lid when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah.
I forgot, you're right there with me. Yeah. Same thing. I suffered mightily, but this also is a nice echo of when we first meet Steve Rogers in the alley getting his ass kicked. Pardon my language, in all ages podcast. And he's holed up a trash can lid to defend himself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, and now here we are.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's anything to the name Broussard other than there's a famous restaurant in New Orleans called Broussard's. But as far as I could tell in my careful, you know, Wikipediaing and Googling, I don't know if that refers to somebody. It could be a set designer or somebody that was in charge of painting.
Well, that's all I got out of it, too. Now, the Marvel movies are famous for putting the names of comic book creators on street signs and that kind of thing, you know, Steve Ditko Avenue or what have you. But I'm not aware of any, you know, old comic book creators named Broussard.
Yeah, I was hoping there was something that I was missing, but I couldn't find it. If there's somebody out there knows, you know, happy to listen to you over at Camp Lehigh. on Facebook, that would help a bunch, but I have no idea. I do notice the one guy in the two-tone suit. It's like a leisure suit that he's wearing in that scene as the boys are running away. I think that was the same suit that Fredo was wearing at the end of Godfather 2. I was just wondering if maybe it's from the same costume designer, but I that's where I seem to recall that outfit, that beige and Brown that the
talking about the guy
wearing.
walking to the right in the dapper
That,
hat.
exactly, yes. Yeah, but
That's
I
funny.
don't know.
So I took a quick detour over to IMDb, and there is a what's a producer? A co-producer, Stephen Broussard,
There you
spelled
go.
that way. And Stephen Broussard, the co-producer, is a there's you know 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 9, there's 10 producers on this thing of different levels. But Broussard was important enough to have a credited assistant. So very well
Oh, okay.
Could be a nod to
It
the
was
producer.
his
He's not an
birthday that
executive
day.
producer, so he's not a money guy, but a co-producer.
Nothing in these movies is by accident. So, since you have your IMDb open, see if there's an O'Malley out there.
Oh, good question. Yeah.
Find us an O'Malley.
Yeah,
And let's find out if they're lucky. I want to dig in and find out if O'Malley is lucky.
the other thing, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out if that's, I think we're still in Manchester, that one street in Manchester where
Oh.
which looks like New York or anything again, and would reappear in although this does look like the Warner Brothers lot. I think it's still in Manchester. This street would also be used in the latest, as we're recording this in 2026, the latest Indiana Jones film.
Oh, sure.
So,
So to answer your question about O'Malley's, I don't see any O'Malley's. There's a few of the of what we'll call apostrophe Americans, like our friend Jim O'Kane. There's O'Connell's, O'Connor, O'Donnell, O'Mahony, O'Reilly, O'Shaughnessy, O'Shea, and O'Sullivan. But
Lots of Italians, I guess.
yes, exactly.
Hey,
Yeah, they're clearly all in Rome. And then there's a Lucas Numicic. There's another good Italian name.
yes.
But these are all in the effects department. All the O's.
Yeah, so
Nothing's by accident.
yeah, and it could be everything behind them is a green screen or a blue screen, depending on what they were using at the time. Usually, the bottom, the bottom 10 feet is real, and everything else above it is green with dots on it.
Man, you just can't tell anymore. I'm looking down the street. There's a block's worth of pedestrians just walking down the sidewalk. They could all be fake. We don't know anymore. You can't tell. They're so good
Yeah.
at this.
And I would be tempted to say, well, 15 years ago, maybe we would know and we could tell,
Well, good point,
but
Hal.
Skinny Steve fools still
Yeah.
fools me. We know all about how that was done. You guys have actually spoken to him. We've talked to the effects artist. We know as much as anybody not on the picture how that was done, and it still fools me. So who
And
knows?
you want to be fooled. You really want
Oh
to
yeah.
just jump into the scene.
I'm very, very happy to be fooled. And that's the thing. I was just having a conversation. I was in a meeting shortly before this, talking with someone, and I was, kind of jokingly apologizing for being so pedantic about some particular thing and being so detail oriented about this. But it's, for this particular task, it was important. But I think I think you guys would say the same thing. I mean, we all love diving into pictures. We love understanding how it was done. We love looking at the details, and we love, delving deep. But I don't go into a movie saying, well, I can't wait to find out what's wrong with this.
Oh no.
The when I especially in the theater environment, I go and sit down and the lights go and I've got my popcorn and the curtains open if it's that kind of theater. That movie has the benefit of the doubt until it loses it. And
Yeah,
and hopefully it doesn't.
and if somebody else makes a mistake, it's okay. But I can imagine if you get a copy
Right.
of your sports aviation magazine and it comes in, and page 78, there's a typo, and all you do is spin right to page 78 and go, I missed this one. I hate it. Nobody's
You
ever going to
had to,
notice it, but I
boy,
hate
you just had to bring up old page 78, Jim. I mean, my God, give it a
that.
rest
Nobody will ever
already.
see it.
I've paid the
Talking
price.
about
I've done my time. No, you're
loving being
absolutely right.
fooled, though. There's when I watch a magician, there's a part of me that really wants to know how they've done it. And once in a while, I'll look it up, and it's always disappointing because it's always simple and stupid. I would rather just watch a magician and just say and be confounded.
Yeah.
Please fool me. This is the
There's
deal we've made.
There was an episode of King of the Hill I watched a few weeks back where Peggy and Hank go to a magic show, and Peggy gets offered as a volunteer, and she climbs into a giant pinata, and the magician sets fire to the pinata, and Peggy disappears. Hank is running around, "Where's my wife?" And Peggy appears back at the at where the table where they were sitting at, and Hank can't figure it out, and it's driving him crazy. And he's sitting in bed saying, "It was a mirror. You never get into the pinata." And she kept going, "No, no." She goes, "I promised, you know, Enrico, I'd never tell his secrets." And so weeks go by, and he finally lures Peggy into the garage. He goes, "I think I have it figured out." So he built this large crate, and he wrote the word pinata on it.
No.
So Peggy climbs into the box. He goes, "Let me see if I have this figured out right." And he puts Peggy in the box. He closes the box. He pulls out a cordless drill and screws the lid on. And so inside the box, Peggy's going, "Okay, now what?" He goes, "Tell me how he did it."
Incredible. For the first like three quarters of that, I was kind of reeling a little bit because a friend of mine, one of my staff at work, like has almost the exact same story right up until the fact point where somebody gets locked in a crate and, you know, basically kidnapped until they tell the truth. But there was my wife and I had tickets to see a magician. It was like first and only time I'd ever bought tickets to do something like that. And then I ended up having to go out of town. So I gave the tickets to one of my employees and who I knew liked this guy and would have fun. And she and her boyfriend went. And he got picked on a couple of times in the audience. The boyfriend did. And this is a, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 seat venue. So it was a pretty good sized thing. Not only he gets picked on a little bit, but then he gets called up on stage. And similar sort of thing. It was something like, you know, he gets zipped into something and then it instantly, and then he vanishes and then reappears somewhere else. And this was 5 months ago. And he will not tell her what happened. He will not tell her how it's done. And I'm saying, so, okay, well, you know, will he tell me? Because this is infuriating. Like, how can he not tell you? That's rule number one with spouses and significant others. There are no secrets.
I thought about threatening
to, like, you know, what? Tell your boyfriend that I'm going to fire you if he doesn't tell you how it is. Maybe that's my version of locking somebody in a crate, but no, he won't say.
And good for him.
Wow.
It, good for him, but damn it, it's driving me crazy.
Gotta know how it happened, yeah.
It's going to break up this couple, but that's good for him.
Yeah, but good for him. Guy on that hill there, Max.
I hope you're happy, Doug Henning, yeah. Doug Henning. One other thing I wanted to bring up in this particular minute on the passage of time, I think the most famous path, this is 70 years. This is, you know, pretty long time, but it's got nothing compared to like the 1 point whatever million, maybe 4 million years in the bone throwing episode in 2001. But I was just trying to figure out some other time jumps. Shawshank Redemption comes to mind. I think there's a jump in there of about 20 or 30 years. Aliens, Ripley goes into hypersleep, and then all of a sudden we see her pop in the second movie. She pops up, and that's been 57 years.
Right.
And Interstellar, I guess you could kind of call that.
Yeah, with the time dilation. Time
jump.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to think of like a jump from one period to another in one scene.
In one cut, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in one cut, that's harder. I mean, Planet of the Apes comes to mind, although, like, we know
there's opening credits. Yeah.
The opening credits, and we know there's a time jump. It's acknowledged that they will be jumping in time. Well, you know, we don't know the big secret that they did not jump in, you know, in space, quote unquote. What? Sorry, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know, that movie's my age, but yeah, what else?
I kept going through and trying to figure it out. I don't know, you know, usually something like on IMDb, they'll have some list of time jump movies, right. But I didn't see any. Things like The Time Machine, where you're sitting there watching, you're watching him go from place to place.
Right.
To the future. Of course. He goes to the year 162,000 or something, but we see that process. It's not the 2001 style cut or this kind of cut to darkness. But I got to tell a quick story about one of my favorite comics. I go to comic conventions once in a while, and I meet a lot of kids who have the little zines that they've photocopied at home. So one kid shows me a zine. He's probably 12 or under. And it starts out, the first four pages are dinosaurs fighting, Tyrannosaurus Rex, Stegosaurus, which didn't live in the same era, but they're fighting. And then he's got a caption that says, "Meanwhile, 70 million years later."
Oh, that's fantastic.
That kid starts has a whole nother story. And I just, first of all, I was thrilled by the audacity of that.
Yeah.
He doesn't know the rules. So it's, meanwhile, 70 million years later, it's like, but geez, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's perfect. That's what comics ought to be.
Yeah. Cut that to the butter toast. Fantastic. It's like, yeah.
Cut to the butter toast. It's one of my favorite memories. I wish I had a copy of that. I should have paid the kid 50 cents to buy that from him. But
you really should.
Oh, man. I just howled when I saw that. It's like, you keep going, kid. You're on something here.
That's terrific. I suppose this may be a very, very distant cousin to the time jump thing, but like anytime I'm watching, and like tangent, here's a question for you guys. BIOPIC. How do you guys pronounce that?
Biopic.
Yeah. Biopic.
See, and I tend towards biopic, but biopic seems like biography. Biopic seems like it should make sense, but I think it's always biopic, but I've never known. But anyway, when I watch one of those, whatever they are, one of the things I'm always most excited about, or even in fiction, like American Graffiti is a good example. You know, you get to the end credits and it's like, okay, where did everybody end up? How did they turn out? You know, we see that in October Sky. But you know, anything where this is a story about a true subject, for some reason, like if you don't give me that at the end, I get very mad. Like, okay, come on, where's everybody now? You know, I'm already halfway to Wikipedia anyway to find out how much of this was accurate, but still, I want to make that jump and no. So like I said, not exactly the same thing, but maybe it goes.
We all know that Bluto Blutarski became a U.S. senator. We all know that.
Right, exactly. Okay, I mean, what other career choice did he have?
George Lucas or kind of hoisted his own petard there when he did that at the end of American Graffiti, because there was an American Graffiti 2.
Right.
And they had to try to fit all these stories into American Graffiti 2 when we already know what happened to all the characters. I don't recall how they solved the problem, but
many people saw American Graffiti 2, certainly not by comparison.
No, and one of the stories at the end of Animal House was resolved in the Twilight Zone movie, because it was the Niederman was shot by his own men. And there's a scene, the Vic Morrow section.
That's right, the Vic Morrow thing. Where
he goes, hey, after you killed Lieutenant Niederman. And so
I forgot about that. I remember that at the time. And then that's when Vic Morrow was killed on that set.
Right, yeah.
It's a horrible memory that kind of tarnishes the whole film. But it was a good movie.
I really enjoyed the movie.
John Landis flick. So, yeah.
So I did have some thoughts on the darkness. Hal was teasing me when we got going. But my first thought was that it cuts to darkness and we don't know what's going on, but we hear kind of a whistling wind, kind of whoosh sound, and reminded very much of the start of the movie where we don't hear the usual Marvel fanfare over the Marvel flippity flip credits. Yeah. And when we had Joe Johnston on our first episode, I actually asked him about that. I said, was that your idea? And he had no idea what I was talking about. I was trying to give him credit for this wonderful idea of mimicking the sound of being trapped in an iceberg for 70 years over the credits. And he was like, I don't know, dude, but I'll take the credit.
Yeah.
But it's the same. It's that mirror here. It echoes. It mirrors that experience of what we heard at the start of the movie is what we hear now toward the end of the movie. So I thought that was very cool. And then the sound of the ball game comes up very quietly. I listened to it four or five times here in this minute. And at first it almost sounds like radio chatter of the guys who were digging Steve out of the ice. And then it slowly resolves and it starts to sound. Then you understand it's a ball game by the time Steve's eyes flicker open.
Right.
But it almost sounds like you're re-experiencing the start of the movie here.
Yeah, and with his eyes closed, it's like that might be what his memories are of coming out of the ice. He didn't hear much. He wasn't quite conscious.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Good.
And you're wondering too, you know, the way some outside influences like that when you're sleeping or sleeping lightly, and they will find their way into whatever you're dreaming about. And that, to me, that raises another question. Did Steve dream for 70 years?
Yeah.
It carry a certain psychological impact, but.
I'm thinking of the, something near your house, Brian, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, where they go back in time. There's this weird montage where they're hearing different radio broadcasts and things going back as they go into the past.
Right.
And those weird, poorly ill, I mean, it was 1980s. It was they did the best they could.
It was the very early days of CGI. And they worked at that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice effort, but that would be another one of those situations where they're all slowly waking up, and you're hearing a ticking clock at the same time. Yeah. So, showing a passage of time that way.
I recall one reviewer of the movie, The Voyage Home, saying that scene of them going back in time and becoming unconscious and the CGI heads are floating around and merging into each other, said something like, Star Trek suddenly takes a turn into bad 1950s Russian sci-fi movie. It's like, what's going on here, you know?
Just what a very delightfully symbolic specific of something. Insult. Yeah,
they did their best with a small budget, yeah.
It's interesting in that dark scene in this minute too, that it's something I've been catching myself thinking a lot about lately. I've been watching some, you know, 70s action TV and some, you know, movies and things from that era, and everything in that era was so heavy handed. Like we were talking about Bionics the other day. And if you, and these little devices where they're telling you this is what's happening. And so to pick a cheesy example, the Bionic Woman, when she goes to listen for something, we zoom in really tight on her ear. And then for the first couple of seasons, she brushes her hair aside and then her ear beeps.
Yep, that's right.
And this whole thing. And then there was another episode recently where, you know, bad guys were going to poison her and the guy holds up a vial. And then we zoom in on the vial, and I swear it felt like it was just dead air for 30 seconds.
Yep.
And you hear the filmmaker say, okay, audience, do you see what I pointed the camera at? Do you know what's happening? And it feels so like the pacing is just exhausting. It feels so patronizing now, but it's just different times, different ideas. But like in this, you know, we go to black and it's almost silent, but there, you know, there has to be a tiny little something there. So that, you know, people are just like jumping up and bolting out of the theater. Well, I guess that's over, but right. Just that little bit of wind noise, a little bit of something, but it's nice that it's so subtle. And I think if this, you know, if we'd made this picture 50 years ago, you'd see, you know, you'd see a clock moving at really high speed and newspapers flashing by and, you know, JFK somebody yelling, time is passing, you know? Yeah, exactly. That's one small step for man. You know, you would, all of these things would be going on and they would just be beating you over the head with this idea that time is passing. And it's nice that number one, it's nice not to be patronized like that. And it's nice that there's, that this is a case that you know, Joe and company are sort of giving us the benefit of the doubt. It's like, don't worry, you'll figure it out. He'll wake up.
Yeah.
And we're going to show you eventually when he is. Don't get too hung up on it, but we're not going to spoon feed you either.
Yeah. It's less is more, I think is the way to
do it. Well, and it also disorients we, the viewers, a little bit. I mean, even if you know the Captain America story and we're paying attention to the start of this movie, if you're playing along, you still don't quite know what's going on here. You know, and it's disorienting, and we see Steve start to flicker awake, and he looks like he's in 1945, you know?
The set design in the room and stuff is well done. And
I'm looking forward to talking about this in the next minute. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, no, it's just, yeah. There's so many temptations here. Yeah.
Don't just save it for the show, save it for the next show.
Yeah, yeah. Tune in tomorrow or the next day. Brian, you had to deal with time passing in your book, Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow. How did you approach that?
Oh, very, very strangely and perhaps poorly. Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow was a book about pop culture history of the space age. And I, one of the conceits of it was, it was a comic book about being a comic book. So the book covers a period from 1939 to the mid 70s. And it talks about how we went from scientific utopianism to pessimistic dystopianism, that kind of thing. And I very deliberately did not age the characters in real time. They don't age 40 years. They age slower. They age at the rate of comic book characters. And so one of my characters in the book is a character called Buddy. He's a young boy at the start, and he turns into a teenager by the end. So he's aged, in human terms, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 years. But I pegged his growth to Robin. Batman's Robin in the comic books. So in 1939, he's about, maybe he's 8 years old or 10 or 12. And by the end of the story, he's maybe 15, 16, 17, which is the arc Robin took in the comic book. So I was trying to make some kind of meta commentary on comics vis-a-vis comics. And I think about four people got that, and the other 20,000 who saw the book were confused. But I was trying something. Yeah.
You know, as I mean, somebody who just who saw that book, had it like on a wish list forever because of the title and the description that I came across somehow, and then finally bought it. And indirectly, my act of buying that book is led to now three podcasts and everything, and that, you know, our whole intertwined origin story. But it's interesting to hear for the first time that, you know, you either look back on it and you say you did it poorly. I disagree, as you're as your Kathy Bates in this situation, your number one fan.
My ankle's almost healed.
Yeah, well, then I can take care of that. I can be in Northern California by tonight. As when I'm reading it, you know, remember that so vividly, what an impact it has, and I just fell in love with it immediately. I remember that point when we're shifting eras and the characters aren't keeping up with it, and I just said, okay. Yeah, it was that simple. It's like, okay, they are not going to age at the same rate. And like, there was never any question of, you know, I'm not sitting there thinking, gosh, my future friend Brian made a weird choice in this. It's like, I don't know if I would have done that. It was just it's something about the fact, like, and I don't want to go too far off on a tangent. I already have. There's something about the fact, you know, buying a hardcover and having this tangible thing in your, like, even more so than reading some digital something. It's like, this is a real book. This is a book that's done, it's published, and I'm taking it at face value. Yeah. And this is how this goes, and I love it.
I appreciate that very much, you know, because I created the rules of this universe and I stuck to them. And yeah, if you went along for the ride, I think it worked for folks who went along for the ride, and some people accepted it. I had a few people question what's going on here, but most people did what you did, which is they just took it at its own terms, entered that universe, enjoyed being in that universe, and, you know, got the story, which I appreciated.
And I've been sad to have left that universe ever since the last time I read it. So it's maybe it's time to pull it off the shelf again.
Man, we can have a conversation. Every time I create a book like that, or The Last Pinocchio Monster, that's got a work of fiction, it is so hard to leave that. You know, for me as the creator of the universe, to leave the universe, I'm almost I miss my old friends.
Yeah. Yeah,
and if I really wanted to, I could make up new stories with those people, with those characters. But I you spend so long working on a graphic novel. It takes 2 or 3 or 4 years to make a graphic novel. You spend that time with those characters you've created, and then one day you just don't have to, you don't knock on their door anymore. And it's a change. It's interesting.
Well, that's, you know, you remind me of what George Lucas said, that great projects are never finished. They're only abandoned. And that's what it kind of feels like when you're done with something. And I know we're coming up at the end of this podcast, and we're going to be kind of, I mean, I feel like previous podcasts that we had, I wish I could go back and do other things. If we could get special people in, I'm always thinking the microphones are open for later episodes. But you have to let it be sometimes, and just be as itself. Yep. Like, that is the work, right. And you gotta walk away.
Yeah. The book, the magazine, the, you know, the story, it's gotta go to press, it's gotta get out there, and you've gotta come to the terms with the fact that it's done, unless you're George Lucas, you know, and you, you can go back and you could just keep tinkering. And that's, you know, I can disagree with a lot of the choices that he made when he did that, but I can't disagree with his right to do it.
No,
you know,
agreed. There's a great story. And I'm not going to remember the name of the painter, but there was a famous French painter. God, it's one of my favorite stories. I wish I could remember the guy's name, but, you know, Romantic era, 1800s, gets his painting, finishes the painting, puts it in the Louvre. Louvre gets it. He's not done with it yet. So one day he packs up his oils and his easel and his bench, and he goes in to set up his little studio in the Louvre. He pulls the painting off the wall, puts it on the easel. The guards come running up. No, 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 monsieur. No, no, you cannot paint it. He says, it's not finished yet. And the guard says, it's in the Louvre. It's finished.
It's so true. It's like, you know, the day before he brought it to the Louvre, it's his project. And he's still working on it. But there's that threshold. And, you know,
make it a little bit better. That reminds me of we were interviewing Jennifer Lavoisier, who's the curator of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, and they used to dread every time Chuck Yeager would come in and visit the Bell X-1, because every time he'd come in, he'd want to go inside the cockpit. And so they'd get a ladder and they'd let him in the cockpit. And the first thing he'd do is whip out a Sharpie and sign his name and date it that he was inside. And they're like, no, it's the X-1. This is history. You can't touch him. It's like, okay, Chuck, your history too. Go ahead and
Yeah, if anybody
sign your name in the cockpit.
Oh my gosh.
That's great.
Yeah, Mike. I've got his signature on the back of my original paper pilot certificate.
Oh, wow.
Oh, how lovely.
Which was pretty cool.
That's great.
So,
wow.
But, yeah.
Well, I think
who doesn't
about...
have the right?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Well, this has been an interesting moment that lasted 70 years. And we found a lot of content, which I always appreciate. But if you'd like to continue this conversation that we've started here, we're always available, as I said earlier, at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode, because it really helps people find our podcast. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We've got some coming up. Fingers crossed that they're showing up, but please tune in. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.